Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast. Welcome back. I'm Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined at the mic by Cheryl Lindemann and Mari Garza, and we are Kettle Selection Team. In other words, we order the majority of the library's collection. And also, we might have some pop-in from our producers, so we'll see what happens. So we've got books. We've had our reading journey has continued. We're coming on the end of summer.
We have goals, but true.
I think we all are not feeling comfortable about.
Yep. Didn't take the bike out, not even once. Yeah. Sad, but true.
I know it's sort of cliche to say that time goes fast, but it felt like this was the fastest summer I've ever experienced. And I know that they say as you age, things get faster and faster. So maybe that's what's happened because I'm close to a really big birthday next year, like a midlife birthday.
Yeah,
like a really big number. And so I'm wondering if that's what happened because I love summer and it was way too short for me. I'm actually in a little bit of mourning about it. But fall has its beauty. I love that too. But just something about, I think it's the long, for me, it's the longer days. I want to be able to get outside. I want to be able to do things more. But I don't like the shorter days. So that's just kind of where I'm at. So thinking about reading this summer, I actually went down a huge nostalgia rabbit hole and went off of my reading that I do more sort of professionally, I would say. And so maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. But
yeah, I feel like I got to read a lot of like hobby sorts of things that I don't normally spend a lot of time on reading. You know, a few years ago, I went on this big hike to Mont Blanc somewhere in Europe, France, maybe Switzerland, countries.
Cool.
It was really, really hard. So I've been interested in hiking for a long time, and I got to reading about Grandma Gatewood, who I'd never really heard of. She was the first woman to hike the Appalachian Trail, like in one hike. Yeah. She was like 67, and this was in 1955. Wow. Ben Montgomery wrote a really good book, and the book is actually pretty old. It's like from 2014. Grandma Gatewood's Walk, the inspiring true story of the woman who saved the Appalachian Trail by Ben Montgomery. And it was just fascinating. Like, you know, we're all about having the right gear, going to REI to get your cool outfit. I don't know. but she was just a very simple living sort of person as far as her trek. Like, she had a little sack that she carried with her. She wore canvas shoes, her Keds that like wore out a ton of times. And what was really fascinating to me is that during that time, there were so many people who would invite her in and let her stay, you know, at their homes. I mean, there were a few people who said, no, get out. But I just thought, wow.
It's a different period where you're actually asking, too.
Yeah. I just don't picture that, here or anywhere. No. When I was in Europe in Mont Blanc, I don't think any of those Europeans would have accepted us into their home as we were hiking along. So anyway, it was really cool. There's also a really nice picture book biography that I want to recommend. Very similar name, Grandma Gatewood Hikes the Appalachian Trail. And that's by Jennifer Thermos. That was fascinating because it had really nice maps, as Cassidy noticed, and pictures and really, really great tidbits, you know, back matter glossary stuff. But yes, we must walk more.
Yeah.
I did
not do enough walking, and I sort of said out loud yesterday, it's worse yet is that I feel like I need to do the really long walk, and I don't take into account any walk would be good. Mm-hmm. I need to just go out. And I got a little better about that when it wasn't hot.
That's fair.
and sort of on either end of the big heat waves, I would go out and just you know, around a couple circles and come back is doing something.
This is true. Even
and
if it's
I always
10 minutes.
Am like listening to something too. So in either a book or a podcast, and I enjoy that time. So I just need to remind myself to just go do that.
Yeah. To Maddie's point about not riding her bike enough this summer, my bike has been sitting by my driveway judging me every time I get
okay,
in the
exactly,
car.
Exactly.
Every time I look exactly. at it, I'm like, I'm sorry. It's not.
Where is
it's not
the
you,
love?
It's me.
I feel that way when I pass like my normal walking path because it's like the street over from where we live, and it's just sort of like I should go. I could just like drive the car down and just start walking in a circle and then get up, you know, it'd be fine. Yeah, but no.
Yeah, it just went too fast.
It did. It just really did.
It's funny in the, you know, working in the literary profession that we do, you get all these blasts for the season. So right now we're getting like witches and pumpkins and books about haunted houses.
Actually, and Christmas too.
Yeah, and Christmas. But it's about May. We get the blasts about summer. And it's so funny because you get this feeling like you're still a little kid, maybe a little tiny bit, and you're going to have all this time for the beach read,
which
I'm not really that into, but like the equivalent of just me thinking I'm sitting outside
the
in the garden.
The freedom to
read. And you have this sort of, it's sort of a mirage. You know, you think it's going to happen to me this summer. This is the one where I'm going to sit out on the porch the whole summer and read.
Well, I actually did do that.
I did
summer.
It some too.
Well, a lot. But not, so I'm really happy
good.
About that.
Oh, it's okay. So that's good. I did it a bit, you know, and I'm glad I did what I did, but not as much as I wanted to. And you always, you seem to think like this is going to be the one. Yeah. And, you know, but, you know, you get there a little bit and that's good enough. And I did, Madi, a little. Thank goodness. Okay. As far as the nostalgia piece, I got really obsessed with books that I read when I was a kid to the point where I was like feverishly searching for, you know, 1980s children's horse books where I couldn't even remember the title, going onto Etsy and digging around. And I did figure them all out. And I actually did read. I spent like a whole half of a month reading these things that I've collected that I've had to purchase a lot of them, honestly. And it kind of brought me to a book that is in the library's collection, and it's called Paperback Crush by Gabrielle Moss, the totally radical history of the 80s and 90s teen fiction. And this is just a really fun book and kind of timely because Francine Pascal, the author of The Sweet Valley Twins, recently passed away last month. Mm-hmm. And it's just sort of a tour of all these children's series related somewhat by or arranged somewhat by topic. So danger or the stories of love is a big one in relationships. And I recognize a lot of these series here. The Girls of Canby Hall.
I'm looking at the back of the book and all the covers on the back.
Yeah.
And it's
Sweet Valley.
Babysitters, Carl Stein, Sweet Valley. It's just like, yep.
And I'm so glad that they're all having kind of their rebranded moment.
Yeah. I mean, oh, yeah. When the kids' books, too.
Yes, for sure.
The Sweet Valley Twins graphic novels.
Babysitters Club.
Cheerleaders. I mean, this, I forgot that existed till I opened this book, but I remember Cheerleaders, definitely. So, and it also talks about, of course, the extreme lack of diversity in these books.
Sure,
and
total.
The very first, yeah.
I mean, really.
The very first Asian American teen book. It talks about the publishing of that. And so it's kind of sad, but also a really good retrospective just to think about that time. Made me think about books and that feeling of being that age and having this, I remember having these big stacks of books at sleepovers and like reading with this friend that was bookish. Thank goodness I had a bookish friend. Or eating Now and Later candies and reading scary stories to tell in the dark at sleepovers. That was another really fun one because I was really into scary books. But Christopher Pike is in here and that was talks about, you know, he has a really good essay in here too. So it's just a really interesting, fun book. I recommend it if you are, you know, millennial or Gen X or had read those books when you were a child, or if you're just sort of interested in looking back and getting a sense of that time, of the way that the books represented the time, which really wasn't totally accurate, but that wave of publishing in that time and some of the issues that were tackled by Naomi Klein, Judy Blume, which we're hearing about a lot about this year. With the reboot, the movie Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, and all the work that she's done, you know, against banning and against censorship. Just a really kind of a fun deep dive.
Neat.
Can I pull off and sort of jump off the R.L. Stein and Christopher Pike? So I just read, or I really want to share, a book that I read relatively recently. It's called Hampton Heights. It's by Dan Coy. The subtitle is One Harrowing Night in the Most Haunted Neighborhood in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And this is a short book of sort of interlinked short stories about a group of six paperboys in the 80s who are taken by their manager, their subscription manager. They're kind of conned into going and selling subscriptions door to door in the most haunted neighborhood in Milwaukee. and the the prize at the end is a dinner at Burger King. All these boys want just their dinner at Burger King, and it is all boys. It is a group, and so it's in chapters. Each kid is sort of they're paired off, and then the supervising manager or the subscription manager has a bit of a story of his own. But they all kind of go off in different directions, and they all have varying degrees. It's light horror. It's funny. It's all kinds of, there's a ghost story, there's a fairy tale story, there's a creature story, a couple of creature stories, but it's just one night in the life of this, but it really looks at kind of growing up, vulnerability in boys. It's a diverse set of boys. It's really like, including one of them is Indian, and his grand goal is to actually go to Burger King. Aww. Think about this. Beef is not a thing in his family. But it's just interesting, fun, you know, it's horror, but for people who don't need gruesome horror, it's very light. It's kids. He never wanted to do anything bad to kids. So it's just a fun, funny story. But very nostalgic.
Very interesting. So I was a paper girl. I earned my Detroit News wagon. I used to pull it along. And if you would believe this, at the end of my route, there was a Burger King.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Livernoy and Burner in Detroit.
Of course.
Oh my
gosh.
You're living their dream. Yes. How does that feel?
Yes. Yeah. And it has a great cover.
I did have a few horror stories, but I won't share them. Yeah.
It's this beat up van, because it's like the van at the end of the evening. There is a what could be a werewolf or a Sasquatch or something. There's a couple of different funny looking creatures on it, and a Burger King without the actual. It certainly looks like a Burger King, even though it doesn't say it on the cover. It's a fun read.
It's awesome.
Yeah. So I was thinking about how great the book that Cheryl mentioned was, reminding me of a graphic novel I've read in the last couple of weeks called How It All Ends. It's by Emma Hunsinger. And it is hilarious. I think, like, especially middle grade, early high school, I guess if you want to say girl books, but really any awkward teen who's out there wanting to like get out there and learn about life in the world, they are just having a total moment in publishing. And this title is about a kid who's actually at the end of seventh grade. The principal or someone calls like three or four students into the office and, hey, you're so smart, you get to go to high school next year instead of going to eighth grade. And she's like, okay, whatever. But
it's kind of scary.
Right before school starts, she starts getting really panicked because she has this older, cool sister, slightly older, cool sister, Isla, who's just like, oh, no, high school's nothing like middle school, you know. And she paints it out to be like this huge campus. It's not that big. But it is just so funny because their sense of humor in the family. Like, I mean, there's a little baby in the family. She still enjoys playing with her toddler brother. He's Baby Wizard. And there are all these scenes. She's like, I don't know if I'm mature enough for high school. I can probably do the work, but I don't know. And so as it rolls out, you know, what's really notable, which I thought was a little over the top, her last class period, I think it's English class, and it's like mostly boys, 80% boys in the class, and they are really wild, like super crazy. I mean, at one point, like the two boys are pretending that one of them is having a baby, and it's so nutty. But she meets one girl in the class, and they get partnered up as not community partners, but group project partners. And it's just a really fun read about how changes in life, like seasons in life, like you're just making these little shifts in school. I really, really enjoyed it. It was both funny and it just made me think about, like, I think school can be really stressful for some children, especially middle school, even high school. You know, it's, and these books, they add a little tiny bit of levity that just like, hey, I'm going to relax. I'm going to have fun and bust a gut laughs. Like the opening scene about salad not being substantial food for dinner. I mean, it was just hilarious. Super funny. So that's it.
All right.
Awesome.
Well, I kind of want to break out just briefly because we posted a question on Facebook a few weeks ago. We've got, we asked what was the best book you read in K-12, and y'all came out. We had, I think, about 113 comments or so, something like that, with actually only about 70-ish distinct titles. I mean, there's a lot of overlap. Big love for The Outsiders, Judy Blume and Beverly Cleary both. You've got the small Harry Potter group, but we also had like all over the place. And you could tell we've got multiple generations in our group listening. So that's it, or following on Facebook. Cause we've got Sherlock Holmes. We've got the ones I know were Lansing School District, having grown up in it, that I know they were just standard for years. There's like Catcher in the Rye is in there. We've got, Witch of Blackbird Pond, To Kill a Mockingbird, Of Mice and Men, those types of books. But we also had people, and we also had people take it different ways. There was favorites assigned and favorites that we picked on our own. And it was a neat list to see. Of more recent ones, we had Walk Two Moons, we had the children's ones included Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and James and the Giant Peach, Lion and the Witch in the Wardrobe, Tales of the Fourth Grade, nothing. I mean, Bloom and Clary actually kind of went out here, but Sweet Valley came up. It was really interesting to, Hatchet, a lot of love for Hatchet.
Yes.
Lots and lots of love for Hatchet. And it's
Never Die.
A particular person commented that it was a really great book for a diverse set of readers in class. And I really agree with that because it's one of those ones that really, my brother was one of those people Hatchet was one of those ones that actually caught his attention and kept him involved. So that was a cool one to see.
Huh. Was Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry on that list?
It was on there.
All right. Yep. That was one of my favorites. Except I'd have to say it was K-14.
When my class read Hatchet, it was the first time I saw some of the kids in my class actually reading the book, ever.
Exactly.
I grew up with these kids, K-12. This was the first time they were actually someone asked about going on to, what's that? There's a website that gives you the 411 on a book if you don't want to read it all. What is that?
Cliff Notes. That, yes.
Yeah, they got mad that someone tried to look it up on Cliff Notes because they're like, you're going to give me spoilers.
Aww.
It was fantastic.
Yeah. That is like music to my ears.
Cool.
Just to have that sort of buy-in from the whole class.
Right. It was neat. Probably the most fun week I've had in English class.
Yeah.
It was
That's really neat. And I'm not sure. I don't know if I could come up with my favorite. There were different ones that I liked for different reasons. I was thinking through the ones that a lot of the ones I read and liked are on this list, but some odd ones that I kind of wonder how we actually managed to get on the list. Yeah. I have a class that read a whole different set of books than what it was a new teacher to the district at the time. And it was a different set of books than everybody before had read. So I read Siddhartha as a freshman and we did Things Fall Apart as a freshman.
Oh, wow.
And instead of Hamlet, we did, now I'm going to blank, The Tempest.
Oh, very cool.
Which I love. That's one of my favorite Shakespeare plays versus everybody did Hamlet and Macbeth and Romeo and Juliet. And we did do Romeo and Juliet, but we spent more time on The Tempest.
And you read Louise Erdrich in school, which blew my mind. Yes. We did not read Louise Erdrich in school.
I'm not even sure I read any of her books until I became a librarian. I mean, I know they were out there, but they did not come across my reading list from school.
I just read a thread online. I think it was yesterday where people were talking about the different books they read in their English classes in high school. And someone said that they had just maybe not so good high school experience, and that they read Lord of the Flies in class 3 different times throughout
goodness.
High school.
Whoa.
But they said the tests got easier.
Well, I mean, one would hope they would in that sense.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if that was like a purposeful thing on the school's part.
Really to drive get, the
yeah.
message home.
Yeah.
Well, some but classroom then, control feeling there.
But on the other hand, one of the books that was not my favorite was The Great Gatsby, because I feel like we analyzed that one to death.
We did too.
I agree.
I mean, I just have, you know, the green light, the eyes,
the green the, light.
This, and it's always the green light. Always the green light. But that said, one of the books I read, actually finished last night, was The Chosen and the Beautiful, which is a new book by Nevo. And it's a reimagining of The Great Gatsby. And it's really looking at gender, sexuality, racism in this time period and now. I mean, it's really appropriate for now. But it's just, it's a decadent story to dive into. It's that jazz 20s. In this case, the Jordan Baker character is an adopted Vietnamese woman who, you know, fits in that her family has money, but, you know, she's a second class citizen in this society that is very white focused. And then you've got Gatsby and Nick and Daisy and Tom are all in it. And then there's also a level of magic, and maybe deals with the devil and some interesting paper cutting magic that just makes the story really fascinating. And I actually really picked this up for a couple of reasons, but one of them is that this one actually came out in 21 or 22, so it's not new anymore. But there is a standalone story featuring Nick, and if you know how this book ends, that's kind of an interesting twist. And Gatsby coming out in the new year, so I was sort of getting ready because I'm really curious as to how that's going to go.
Yeah, that sounds really good. I remember reading Gatsby the same way in high school, and I was, I never wanted to see it again, but I did.
I felt the exact same way. I was like, can we be done with this already?
Seriously. But I picked it up as an adult, and I actually really liked it. But I really feel it sometimes when you read those things, it's like it turns you off of them, and then I just didn't have enough context of anything for that book. Mm. It didn't make any sense to me. You know, until I was older, then it was like, oh, okay.
But there's also a whole lot of subtext that we didn't discuss in school.
Yeah,
in
right?
that book,
yes.
Which is what Nevo is really playing with, is the very real parts of the book that were there that we did not discuss in high school.
Yeah.
Because we didn't talk about the sexuality and
I'm really interested in books that are retellings of books that people have read before. I've been reading Natalia Holt's The Queens of Animation, which is talking a lot about like Disney female animators and early
really
Disney.
Good.
It's amazing. Like I come from an animation background. Yeah. I've learned a lot of like facts about like the tools they're using and things like that. But it's really nice to have it all put together historically, like from the women's actual perspective and hear like what was life like in the 1940s working on Bambi and things like that. But they're talking a lot about like the women who developed these stories and how they're like drawing from stories that already exist in Europe, Bambi, Pinocchio, all sorts of things like that, like The Little Mermaid even, and how they've like taken stories that are a lot darker and sort of reimagined them for family audience and things like that. And it's really interesting to read sort of how that process comes about and like what they decide to keep and what they decide to change and how that impacts the story even visually. So I think it's really wonderful, even like totally off topic, but they're talking about when they were making Fantasia, how they included a Song from the Nutcracker Suite in Fantasia. And prior to Fantasia, the movie coming out, the Nutcracker Suite was not performed at all in the US. It was basically unheard of. And Fantasia popularized that. It became such a hit. One of the conductors that worked on the movie started having his musicians play the Nutcracker Suite, and it just blew up in the U.S. and now it's as popular as it is today. But it took a woman like going into a record store and hearing this European classical music and feeling like excited by it to even get it into the U.S.'s like scope. It's really, really interesting. Wow. So I just love like things like this where it's like, okay, the Great Gatsby, maybe we're a little tired of it as a culture, but like, how can we tell it again and reinvent it in a way that's interesting in the modern age? Right. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. And what's hiding in it that we haven't examined,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So cool. Getting back to our books for kids, I want to recommend Little Shrew by Akiko Miyakoshi. I don't know if anybody remembers, what was it called? Tea Party in the Woods. Beautiful, beautiful picture book. And so Little Shrew, I had to look this up. I was like, wait a minute, shrews, they're real animals, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Like, yes, they are. They're like little mole animals. I'm like, okay, just wanted to double check that. But this is an incredibly just adorable, compact little J-fiction book or chapter book. In the reviews, some of the reviewers were saying that it could be like considered an early reader. We put it in the actual chapter book because there's three distinct stories of this little shrew living his very simple but very satisfying life. He's waking up, he's going to work, and all the characters around him are not animals. They're real people. And, you know, he has people in an office and, you know, they go out to lunch together and, you know, they take the train home together. And, you know, he's waking up, he's having these situations in one of the stories, like where he's bartering, he's at a thrift store, maybe a garage sale or something, and, you know, trying to get a hold of a TV. And it is just adorable because it is very simple text. And I think, I like to think that, you know, that early reader, that child grade, good reader at grade one, grade two, grade three would really enjoy like having a satisfying read because it's kind of picture bookish, but there are definitely more words on the page than a typical picture book. But the illustrations are just beautiful. There's so many like little details of Little Shrew's apartment and, you know, there's a New Year's scene. I can't gush about this one enough. I really, really enjoyed it. And the illustrator and author, same person, just really magical to me anyway. So that would be Little Shrew by Akiko Miyakoshi.
It's nice to see something even a bit more substantial for that age too.
Yes. You know,
something to like launch it from the series, which are great, like the branches or whatever. And just
right.
That's a little bit more. Yeah. It sounds really good. Mm-hmm. It's very cute.
Yes. And it has a dial-up phone on the wall. I mean, kids will be like, what was that? On the cover anyway.
So very loosely related because we have everyday life and animals. I read The Full Moon Coffee Shop by Mei Machizuki. This one, it's again, sort of interlinked stories that come together. It starts with a screenwriter who's sort of hit rock bottom and is sort of trying to figure out what to do next. She's pitched some ideas to an old acquaintance who is in town and has invited her for coffee. So they end up going to coffee in Kyoto. And she says, I'm sorry, we can't do anything with this. And she just sort of, she just doesn't know what to do at this point. And to people kind of have overheard and recognized who she is, and they're like, well, you know, you're not staying with the times. You're a great writer. I love your stuff, but I mean, just it got sort of to the end, sort of didn't quite fit. And it's an older gentleman and a younger gentleman, and the older gentleman is, you need to stop, quit picking at her, that sort of thing. But they tell her that maybe she should stop by the Full Moon Coffee Shop, and she doesn't know what they're talking about. She's never heard of the shop. But she goes and she sort of walks out the direction that they sort of said it was in, and suddenly it's dark outside, and she kind of sees the road that it's supposed to be on, and she goes down, and it's like a pop-up shop is what she sees, and it's just sort of the end of this road. There's a parked cafe and chairs out, and somebody else, they'll just be out in a minute, and she sees, you know, off to the side, a person sipping coffee, and then the next thing she looks, it's a cat. And then the waiter comes up, and it's a cat. And that cat gives her some life advice, reads her stars, and sets her off on a new path. And this sort of happens repeatedly for the characters in the story. They find their way to this cafe that just sort of appears where it needs to appear. And it's a group of people who all just need to slow down, rethink, reevaluate, and you know, figure out, take the time to figure out what's important to them and what direction they want to go. But it's also about kindness, and it's about it's very, if people liked What You're Looking For Is in the Library by Michiko Oyama, or there's a new book called We'll Prescribe You a Cat by Ishita Sho. And then there's another one coming, it's holdable now, it's called The Healing Season of Pottery by Yon Soman. There's this sort of a new mini, it's not new because a lot of these have been released in Japan and Korea already, but it's this coming into the United States. It's a mini genre of, it's self-help, it's slow down, it's, you know, really think about what you're doing, looking for something meaningful, or just don't let yourself get burned out type stories. And I've been finding them very interesting. I think we're all approaching numbers. Right. But it's an interesting thing to see in it, and they've become very popular as well.
Yeah. Sounds really cathartic.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. They always have really great covers.
And the cats are wonderful. They're just a wonderful, they are basically the planets. It's very interesting as you listen there's a reason they're dealing with this particular set of people, and that is revealed as you go along in the book. And it's just a nice story.
I think I wish a cat would visit me.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
Where's the
I want that cat.
I know.
Exactly. It's where you least expect it. It's one of those things.
Love it.
A cat did visit me. It had fleas.
Oh, well, not that kind of cat.
She's doing great now, though.
Oh, good.
She has turmeric and she has a new family.
There you go. There you go.
That sounds like a health code violation at the cafe.
Well, I mean.
You don't want fleas with your scone and your latte.
Wow, that sounds lovely. You're right. There are so many of these books coming out that are providing something that we really need right now.
Mm-hmm.
Those messages. I'm going to take a little step off of the discussion just to talk briefly about what month we're entering. On the 15th of September through October 15th, we are going to begin Hispanic Heritage Month. And this was started as a week-long celebration in the Lyndon Johnson administration, and then the Reagan administration, actually, it turned into a month-long celebration. And we always talk about this, so we want to celebrate books by diverse creators all year round, but it's a nice time to concentrate and focus. We usually have displays in our libraries calling attention to the beautiful works by Hispanic and Latino creators and authors. So I have a couple to discuss today. One I haven't finished, but the other I did. And this is one of those books, I don't know if you have these, I'm sure we all do, books in your head that you want to read on that giant mental TBR. And this one was called is called Bless Me, Ultima, the classic novel by Rodolfo Anaya. And this is a book from 1972. Mm. And it's considered one of the greatest works of Chicano literature. It's been studied over and over. And unfortunately, it was never studied in my school.
Exactly.
And we had a discussion about this. Why weren't we reading this along with Gatsby, right? And that's a whole other conversation. And I have seen in schools with a daughter that's in school that things are changing on that front now, especially in her district. I think it
because
does depend
even
on where you are.
I listed off some different authors, but I still can't remember. And if anybody who's at Everett with me can remember, I can't remember reading Hispanic authors within our classes.
We can't
remember any.
I doubt I ever read anything like that. Wow. It's literally all the classics, but yeah. I mean, they're all written. Yeah.
Because
you know,
I don't think I read Marquez until college.
Yeah, that wasn't in high school. No, we didn't. I didn't have it either. Yeah,
me either.
And that's kind of what I want to say about this book is this is a classic in every sense. When I'm reading it, I'm thinking To Kill a Mockingbird. I'm thinking it's the exact same importance and power, imagery, mythology. The characters they feel archetypal, you know, and it's just wonderful. But it's about a boy named Antonio living in New Mexico. And it's a true coming of age story. Starts when he's very young and goes up until, you know, his young adulthood. And it's a story of this in the 1940s of his family, and they live in the town. But his mother is of a farming family of La Luna. That's what they're the earth people. And his father is of the wind, is a mares or of the water, and it's a vaquero family. And the father had to leave the horse life and go and live in the town. And the boy is pulled in those two directions. He's pulled to this sort of vagabond, wandering life, and he's. His mother really wants him to become a Catholic priest. His mother's very, very religious in the Catholic tradition. And it's about that push and pull between the religions because his grandmother is a curandera. And she comes, her name is Ultima, and she comes and lives with them when she's much older. And she's very well respected within the community, although there's whispers that she's a bruja a little bit behind the scenes. And there is an extremely violent story that comes in. I'm actually not going to say what that is, but it involves his family and Ultima being greatly threatened. There are curses. There are exorcisms of sorts in this book. There's a lot of symbolism. There's the golden carp. This is just as good as the green light, right? It's just different, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the golden carp. We have the owl, which is on the cover of every version of this book. The owl is Ultima's soul, and the owl saves people, and the owl does become threatened in the book as well. So I'm so glad I read this book. I feel like it was sort of an honor to read this book, and I highly recommend it to anybody as an American classic. Mm-hmm. So should be considered part of our American classical canon. I believe it is in some respects. Mm-hmm. And it does reference that, especially in New Mexico, it was used in schools. It was also banned a lot.
Yes,
I believe that.
Yeah, a lot.
Yes.
As classics often are.
Yes, exactly, right? yeah, exactly. But it, ultimately, at its heart, it's a book about kind of love and family and place and identity and self-realization with these things pulling at you and trying to find who you are amongst it. I mean, what a classic story. It's like what so many of those other classics are about. So just a wonderful book. The other one that I have, I'm only halfway through, and I tend to not want to bring a book if I haven't finished it, but it's so good and it was so relevant to Hispanic Heritage Month, of course, that I wanted to bring it. I knew I was going to read this book when I first saw the cover, actually. It's called The Volcano Daughters, a novel by Gina Maria Baribrera, and she's a Michigan author. She grew up in San Francisco, but she does. Was educated at the MFA program at University of Michigan, and is a Michigan author. She did a book signing at Literati, an author event, Literati bookstore in Ann Arbor recently. And what drew me to this is that it's a novel about El Salvador. And I know that I'm sure our listeners and I could find novels about El Salvador, but I can confidently say that they're a bit scarce. There aren't as many of them. It's not something that you see every day. And this was inspired by her father is Salvadoran
and about her father talking about a massacre that actually did happen in the 1930s under a dictator. And this is a fictionalized story. And it kind of goes back to what some of the things we've talked about today about, you know, how a story is told, about how someone can tell a new story, or Ta-Nehisi Coates saying, you know, who gets to tell the story. And what this is, why she wrote this, is to tell the story of the indigenous women who were, they live in a volcano, and they're made to work. They're called colonas. They're coffee farmers. They work. They give the plantation a ton of money. They get paid in these little coins, and they get paid just enough to survive. And they can't grow their own food. They can only grow the coffee. So to make a long story short, I really encourage you just to pick this one up and read it. But it's about two sisters who are pulled to the capital against their will. One when she was a baby, one when she's 12 years old, ripped away from their mother. And they're made to work for this terrible dictator. El Gran Pendejo is what he's called in the book. And that is what it's called. But he does have a name in history. And he believes in a lot of superstition, as was really kind of common at the turn of the century. And he believed in purity, racial purity, and making things more white. And he takes the older daughter, or the younger daughter, and he makes her his oracle. And she has to consult on all of these really intense matters of state. She really has no idea, but she's terrified of him, so she does. So what this is basically the story of these two sisters, all of the women, that the young girls who were left back in the village, who end up dying in the massacre. They are our narrators in the story. So our narrators are Lourdes, Maria, Cora, and Lucia, and they're narrating from the grave. And what they did is they said they held on to the threads of the two main characters, and they followed them through the story, which is going to take us out of El Salvador into the United States. And I can't wait to finish reading this. I think it's been compared to Isabel Allende's early work, most definitely, just absolutely magical, captivating, very dark, very haunting and moving, but just a beautiful,
that one
beautiful and difficult book.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. All right. I think that's all we have for today, but it has been fun. Thank you for joining us. The extra voices were our producers, Rissa and Cassidy. And everybody has a wonderful reading journey, and we'll talk to you next month.
Okay. Thanks for joining us.